Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled, A Forum, Profiling the Yakima Valley Hispanic Ministry, presented by Julianne Ross, number ROJ-2003. Let's listen in.
My name is Rebecca Saldana. When I first started working with farm workers as a student, it was with Eastern Washington and Oregon. And upon graduation, I went to work for a farm worker union down in Oregon, which is called BECUM, Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United in English, Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste in Spanish, which works in the Willamette Valley, which is very similar to Skagit Valley if you're from Washington. But it's very diverse, small, medium, some large growers, and a large population of farm workers that are organizing to try to change their lives. And so this video highlights the Willamette Valley, which is where I worked for the last 2 years. And now I'm working here in Washington, doing working with the National Farm Worker Ministry, which I'll talk a little bit more about, and primarily doing consumer education by outreaching to interfaith communities, both in Seattle area and in Eastern Washington and Central Washington. So, very excited to be here.
As a consumer, I think we all have a responsibility, first of all, just to be more aware and conscious of where our food comes from. For most of us, our food comes from Safeway, Albertsons, Kroger's. We don't think too much about where it's grown, who picks it, under what conditions. And so the first step is just to stop and to ask those questions. Where does this product come from? Who is picking it?
If we eat fruits and vegetables, we eat food that was hand-picked, a lot of it, by farm workers. And those farm workers are largely immigrants these days. And their life expectancy now is about 48 years old. In a country where the life expectancy is in the 70s for most of the rest of us, something's wrong with that picture.
Farm workers are paying a price, right, to put food on the American table. And the consuming public's got to understand that farm workers can no longer afford to live and be treated that way.
The United States pays less for food than any other industrialized nation in the world, and it's not right that it should be on the backs of these people who are working in the hot sun, doing all these things to get the food to our tables. I mean, I think it's just an absolute travesty that we continue getting food that they're paying for by their sweat and blood.
Hay muchas condiciones malas. Por ejemplo, estamos trabajando a medio fin y no ponen agua, entonces no nos consiguen, no ponen agua. Los baños muchas veces ya están llenos y inclusive a veces no tienen ni baños. Y si la gente anda a medio fin, al final tienen que venir hasta acá, hasta el otro lado del fin, caminar como media milla o menos de media milla, o hasta más, inclusive una milla más para hacer sus necesidades fisiológicas. Y en eso están también corriendo el tiempo. En algunas ocasiones a los mayordomos vienen, les gritan, les regañan, los tratan como si fueran unos animales y eso no tiene que ser, no tiene que pasar eso.
Yo el trabajo no, el mayordomo me trata pues más o menos, a veces me dicen que sana a mí, ¿no? Que malas palabras a mí. Cuando uno está trabajando bien y a veces llega uno ahí, ¡pas! Una patada y ese es de abacho. Llega y ¡zas! Una patada, a veces ¡zas! En la cabeza, ¿sí, no? Y eso saca de onda, ¿no? Pues uno vive enojado acá, pues ¿qué ves? ¿Qué ves? Esto no gusta y luego estás y luego algo que no le parece, luego le dice, oh, ¿quieres ir para tu casa? Dale, vete.
No, sí, tuve problemas con algunos rancheros porque explotan al trabajador, porque como uno no sabe realmente cómo están las leyes aquí en este estado, o los sueldos, o el temor de que pierda uno el trabajo y ¿qué voy a hacer? ¿Tengo que mandar dinero a mi hijo, mantener a mi familia? A veces se aguanta uno pues a la explotación.
We just talked to some of the workers here, and apparently it's very clear that the workers here are very scared, they're intimidated. We went upstairs to talk to one worker, and it was clear that they were not even making minimum wage here, like they won't complain. And in fact, this guy that we talked to earlier, he asked me a question, whether what he made in a day had to be the equivalent of $6.50 an hour times 8 hours. And he had worked 10 hours and wasn't even making minimum wage. So I told him, by law, you have to make at least minimum wage, whether you're paid by piece rate or whether you're paid by the hour. You know, you still have to make minimum wage.
The labor camps are down dirt roads. They're on private property. You do not see how the people live who are the folks that are putting the food on our tables. And it's awful. Even the best labor camp is pretty bad, and lots of them are nothing short of a disgrace.
El ranchero le brinda pues casa, pero realmente no es casa, sino es una galera hecha por lámina nada más, y donde lo ocupa como garage, guarda su herramienta y todo lo que no le sirve, ¿no? Y ahí mete dos, tres familias, pues, eso es lo que les brinda él a la persona, pues, las personas que llegan a trabajar con él. Pues por ese lado es un poco malo, ¿no?
The wages of farm workers on average about $8,000 a year, and that's usually gross before taxes. Even though farm workers are not citizens, they still have to, well, most of them are not citizens, they still have to pay taxes, which takes out a large chunk of their income. And $8,000 is very little to raise a family on. Oftentimes both parents will work, and sometimes even young adults or adolescents will work, but it's very hard to make it.
It's very difficult to work, because here you have to pay for the rent, for the food, for the bills, and you're left without anything. No saca uno para más. Y lo puedes quedar, pues, también los trabajos, pues no pagan mucho y pues, aumenta el trabajo, pero no aumenta el sueldo. Es lo malo, ¿verdad? Te ponen a trabajar más, pero no te aumentan el dinero.
Fuimos a pedirle ahí, pues, aumento todos, ¿no? Pues todos fuimos a pedirle aumento y dijo, no, pues si quieren trabajar bien aquí, sí. Si quieren trabajar bien así con el sueldo este, o si no, ya váyanse a su casa, ¿te cuentas? Así pues, así me tratan, ahí los tratan así pues.
Farm workers have not enjoyed a lot of the benefits that other workers have had in this country for years and years and years. And the reason is because farm workers have been excluded from all the major laws and protections that other workers have. And it's a race thing. The fact that farm workers were not covered by the National Labor Relations Act in the 1930s had to do because the majority of farm workers at that time were black.
This is a group of people that have been woefully forgotten in the labor process, have been woefully neglected socially and legally.
It has to do with power, and it has to do with race. A lot of growers say, you know, yeah, I treat my workers fine, you know, I get along with those people. And they always are referring to those people. But the bottom line is that they never talk about, well, you know, I'm going to give my workers a say in the workplace. And what that means is evening out the playing field, but they won't do that. You know, and we're not talking about economics either. We're talking about giving the workers a voice that's not economic, like a seniority process, a grievance procedure, union recognition. Basic things that other workers have enjoyed in this country for the last 70 years.
It's like a vicious cycle of being left out of the educational process, of being left out of the political process. And so farm workers for over 40 years now through the farm worker movement, have been organizing themselves, have been unionizing for better pay, for better conditions, for benefits.
Cruzamos dos primas hermanas y el esposo de ella, de una de ellas, el hijo del coyote para nosotros. Caminamos dos días en el cerro, todo un día sin comer y sin tomar agua. Después llegamos a una casa, únicamente la señora nos ofreció agua, nos ofreció comida. Nos pasamos todo un mediodía sin tomando más agua.
The border crossing stories are permanent and they're very etched in people's mind, and the experience of being undocumented, of being illegal and being sort of labeled and really racialized in that sense really sticks with people. Even after they're legalized, people don't forget that, and they still understand the way people look at them and the way they perceive them.
Sufriría menos pues el inmigrante. Y al tener documentos o venir contratado por cierta temporada, ya con la seguridad de que no va a tener problemas para abrir una cuenta en el banco, para mandar dinero a su familia. Porque para todo eso el inmigrante no tiene esas garantías.
We have a set of laws that basically says there's no room for people. We invest enormous resources and spend tremendous effort in keeping people out. And at the same time, we have an economy which is saying, well, actually, there is room. But if you're willing to assume all the risk of dying in the desert or up in the mountains, the risk of being caught and sent back, the risk of working and living under a different set of standards and conditions than the rest of the American workforce, if you're willing to take all the risks, we again need you in this economy. So we need an immigration law which acknowledges the truth that our laws have so far failed to acknowledge. That there is room economically for people, and that we are better off, and they are better off, if we endow these people with their rights, with full access to labor rights, full ability to join unions, and you know the ability to complain when their labor rights are violated, and that really means providing them access to legal status.
Una situación muy triste porque nosotros aparentemente vivimos felices aquí, pero eso es una mentira, porque todos los días uno se levanta con la preocupación de que hoy salí a trabajar y es posible que no regrese, y tenemos hijos que necesitan de nosotros, que dependen de nosotros. Es un riesgo que corre uno, y no somos criminales. Cometimos un delito, sí, lo acepto, al entrar aquí legalmente, pero es un, como llaman aquí, es un delito pequeño en comparación de muchos delitos graves que cometen otras personas, ¿no? Entonces nosotros el delito es venir a querer vivir bien, conseguir una forma de vida más digna, de comer lo que nunca hemos comido. O sea, venimos a buscar vivir bien y a la vez contribuir.
Farm workers have contributed economically to the prosperity of Oregon. Oregon's economy is agricultural-based, forestry-based, and Latinos, farm workers, immigrants make up the backbone of those industries. They might make up the backbone of agriculture, of tree planting, of food processing. Contrary to the belief that many people have about that immigrants take away jobs from U.S. citizens, that's just a total myth. The truth of the matter is that immigrants create jobs. Because for every crop that's picked, that crop has to be transported, which creates jobs, has to be processed, which creates jobs, has to be marketed, which creates jobs, and then ultimately has to be sold to the consumers, which creates jobs. So we're actually creating jobs and then taking away jobs. So I think that we have contributed greatly to Oregon, and that matter to the whole country.
There's 8.5 million people who are here living and working and functioning. Their employers need them, their labor unions want them, they're a presence in our economy, and frankly, without them, I wonder whether our economy would survive.
Que si hicieran uno o dos.
explains some of the issues of farm workers, and it gives you a bit of a sense of farm worker reality that I can also share and amplify with more stories. And I just really want to make this kind of a discussion as opposed to me just talking. But what I want to do with this short time that we have left,
lights, screen.
Yeah, those are the lights here. Let me just turn the sheet on. But as I had mentioned, is that I work for National Farm Worker Ministry. And the Farm Worker Ministry started in the 60s as a charity and service organization in California, going out to the labor camps, ministering, providing basic needs. And when the farm worker movement in California began with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, who were inspired by Gandhi and Jesus, and the whole community service organizing that was going on with Fred Ross throughout California, they were first organized and organizing the communities around community issues, because the farm worker movement's always been community-based. But for Cesar Chavez and Dolores, they also recognized that the only way to bring real change was to empower farm workers to know their rights, to know their own dignity, and to come together as a community and as workers to change their own lives. And so that's where United Farm Workers came about. And with that, Cesar Chavez got to know Chris Hartmeyer and others who were some of the folks working with the farm worker ministry, and challenged them to accompany them in that struggle. And so since that time, National Farm Worker Ministry has been working to accompany farm workers that are actively organizing to improve their own lives. And what that has meant historically has been accompanying primarily as staff, going and working in California, working in Washington, providing service and providing resources to the movement. Also, of course, Great Boycott, anyone? for certain folks, and then there's new boycotts that are happening now. In Florida, we have farm workers that are organizing with the Coalition for Immokalee Workers that are challenging Taco Bell. In North Carolina, there's workers organizing around cucumbers and pickle company that's mostly Eastern, called Mount Olive Pickles. In California, we've had multiple different struggles, primarily in strawberries and grapes, which are some of the most the crops that use the most pesticides and are the most stoop labor and have the most abuses. And they just won a contract with Coastal Berries, which in the 90s, maybe some knew that they were organizing and trying, they had a strawberry campaign where they were trying to get stores to make pledges of support and try to create pressure. Well, finally, 10 years later, they have about 80% of farm workers in California that pick strawberries under union contract now. So these are great victories. In Washington State, we have our own history where, just like in Oregon, where it's an independent union that's a sister organization, a sister union to United Farm Workers. In Washington, that's also how the farm worker movement began, as an independent union, United Farm Workers of Washington. And they started organizing by communities, because one of the things with farm work is that it is transitional. Even though we have more and more farm workers that are immigrating and staying in our communities here in Eastern Washington, Central Washington, you also have migration within there. You don't have one steady employer that's able to provide you year-round work. And so you work in the cherries, you work in the strawberries, and cherries and the apples, and you may move through in the region. And so one of the ways to not lose momentum is here in Washington, we organize by communities. And so we have town committees that United Farm Workers first organized. We have them in Yakima and Sunnyside and Pasco, and we're trying to revitalize those. Those were organized in the 90s when we had a boycott of Sato San Michelle and Columbia Crest. Workers were organizing to win a contract there. And after an 8-year boycott where many churches in this community and then nationally through National Farm Ministry were organizing and actively participating in this boycott, they won a contract. And now they're in the process of renegotiating for the third time this contract. And so for the first time, you have farm workers in Washington State that are enjoying health care and dental care and have pension plans. And not only that, but have committees on the farms that are organized around to be able to give input about how to better operate as a farm and have a safety and health committee that works on making sure that people are trained and aware and about the best ways to work safely on the job. And that's something that we want and envision for farm workers all across Washington State. But one of the, and what we've been doing with that is, as you've heard what our different issues are, is immigration is a major issue, as well as health and safety. In the orchards and the apple industry, one of the major issues that workers have raised through the town committees and through marches and protests is health and safety. Because of the fact that on the larger farms, there's less of that connection with farmers, and also because of the consolidation that's going on, what you have is you have, like the woman mentioned, is that work increases, but wages don't. And that's the reality here, is that we have workers that climb 10-foot ladders with big cloth sacks that hold up to 40 pounds of apples. So you're climbing up, you're picking, you're climbing down, you're dumping it into a box that you also saw some, but the apple boxes, when they're filled, hold up to 1,000 pounds of apples. And you're doing that from 8 to 12 hours a day. And so we have workers that have permanent injuries, a huge committee of workers that are organizing around how to use the system and work and collect their workers' compensation, which until 1986 was not even, in Washington State, was not even a right for farm workers. And it wasn't until 1986 in Washington State, through efforts of coalitions of both faith communities and United Farm Workers and other partners, that farm workers in Washington State were finally included in the minimum wage, that child labor laws became to apply, were also applied to agriculture in Washington State, and that's when they first were able to get uninsurance employment. And unfortunately, this year in Washington State legislation, the last week, I don't know how aware you all were, but there was this piece of legislation trying to assuage Boeing from not leaving. And part of that deal was to cut large sectors of low-wage workers from unemployment insurance, including 44,000 farm workers would now not being covered by unemployment insurance in Washington State. And so that's the constant reality of farm workers. And so what happened, or what we've been doing, is those have been the rallying issues: health and safety, a living wage, or a better wage, and voice in the workplace, and something around immigration. And so what we've done is the farm workers started by doing protests and strikes in 2000, when that was the first year in the apple industry that there was because of overproduction and consolidation, among other things, was the first time that farmers really, all throughout farmers feel difficulties, but that was a major price reduction in apples, because up until that time, up until 99 and 2000, in the 90s, apple growers were profiting more or less. It was a boom for them. And when 99 and 2000 came, it was a big shift where farmers not only were not making a profit, they were getting starting to get billed from the packing houses, saying that they owe them. And so they weren't even able to cover any costs. And you saw another shift, a wave of farmers having to claim bankruptcy, having to sell their farms. We have a story of a fifth generation farmer who's now 67, who has had to
give up everything and all of his orchard, and that's all he's known. And now he's having to look for other work because he's not able to maintain his farm. He's had to declare bankruptcy. And so what we're seeing is that the strikes alone weren't going to work because one of the little exercises I have here is our apple dollar. And what we see is that the growers are coming to a place where they don't have the same kind of power either. Because farm workers are striking and trying to get more wages and demand more from the employer, but the employer's at a place where they also are feeling helpless, or unable to really make an impact or respond to the employees. And part of it is this apple dollar, and part of it is some systemic problems we have with agriculture, which many of you guys know about, so we can add in too. But here's our apple dollar. And I have it sliced up, our apple. And these are the categories. So we have the supermarket, the growers, the packing sales, the workers, and the transport. So I need you guys to help me with some percentages here. And I've helped you by giving you guys a little premise. I was going to have you guys do this right at the beginning. But so this is 68%. This is a 4%, 4%, 7, and then I think who's left? 19? Oh, you have changes. I think it's 19. So, how many votes for the 68 cents goes to workers? Transport? And you can just raise your hands as packing or sales, growers, supermarket. Very smart crowd. 68% of our current dollar that we spend on apples goes to supermarkets. And this is a study, and it's a study from Washington State University done a couple years ago. So we can only project that this may have even changed more. So then you have 19% going to growers, packing and sales, workers, or transport? Okay. Packing and sales, and the Apple Commission, which has just been disbanded, partly because independent growers were protesting the fact that they were having to spend so much on packing and sales, and then not having their organic apples or their apples that are produced under different conditions, they're all grouped together. And so they protested, and it's actually led to this disbanding. And so now the apple industry is in an interesting situation. It'll be interesting to see what happens. So then we're left with 7 cents, which could go to transport, growers, or workers. So, and that 7 cents does go to growers. And on average, then, you have 4 cents going to the workforce and 4 cents going to transportation. So what the workers discovered in 2000 is that their strikes, while what it did enable them is, because what was happening is that wages were actually decreasing that year, they were able to maintain their wages and get wage increases in many places, but they recognized that strikes, or where we're just targeting growers alone, were not going to allow the real changes that workers want to see, and it would not enable rural communities the type of sustainable lifestyles and results that we want to see, because we're fighting over 11 cents. Mm-hmm. And you can only make 11 cents, so you can only break that up so differently. And so what was started then was this idea of a fair trade, taking the fair trade coffee. Anyone? Mm-hmm. Fair trade coffee? Mm-hmm. Purchase? Yeah. Fair trade coffee? We drink it here, right? Taking those concepts about ensuring a bottom line, a fair price, a fair minimum to those that produce our products to allow them not only to meet their costs, but to have a livelihood and one that's dignified and gives back to the community. And so this idea emerged, and what's resulted now is, that was in 2000, it's now 2003, a staff has been hired And it's through not United Farm Workers, but one of the nonprofits that was also started by Cesar Chavez, which is called La Unión del Pueblo Entero, which is the community's union, more or less, the entire community. Because we recognize that in order to make a real change in here and bring dignity and address the issues of the farm workers and the growers, is that we need to bring in the entire community and primarily the consumers. And so National Farm Worker Ministry, about September, October, hired me on to be in Seattle to accompany this project and this process, primarily to do consumer education and outreach about the current situation of farm workers and growers in Washington State and what are some different possibilities that we could foresee if we had a strong consumer base that's willing to work with us to not only say that they're willing to pledge to pay a little bit more, but also work with us to accompany us as we do this. Because what this whole premise is farm worker led, but it can't go without the growers. And so farm workers are initiating new types of relationships with growers through this nonprofit and through this Apple Project. And the Apple Project is still getting their name. One new idea that they're coming to is Apples, meaning Apples Project, which is agricultural partners providing leadership in economic and environmental sustainability. So we'll see what lasts. I don't have any business cards, or neither do they yet. But the idea then is farm workers creating these new partnerships with growers, because it takes both the growers organizing themselves and coming together and recognizing the farm workers as equal partners in this process. And that's one of the things that this crisis has resulted, the crisis because of our free trade agreements and this consolidation both of land and retailers that has allowed growers who have always seen themselves as part of Washington Farm Bureau, has always identified more with packers. They're starting to say, you know, really when I become aware of this situation and aware of these agreements and the way that that of all the people on the chain, the grower is the one person that doesn't receive a wage. After everyone else gets not only their wages but their profits, then whatever's left over is what the growers get currently in the current system. And they start to see themselves more related to the farm workers, which is a major shift. And it's an opportunity. And so what we're asking consumers and people of faith in Washington State primarily first, but we expect that this will be something that goes out and just because apples are known globally. And we have aided, the apple industry has aided in some poor practices with our sisters and brothers in Mexico and Canada. We haven't been working in international solidarity with them. But it's one thing that we want this project to do. So what we need of you is to help us in a couple of different ways. One is we're trying to create committees that will get trained in this whole process as it develops to be able to talk with your congregations about it and build bases of support. Right now, we're looking at a pledge card. So building up our base of contacts that and people that are committed to this idea, so that when we decide that we're going to work with certain retailers, that we can say, look, we know that this is something that's going to be a win-win situation for you as well, because in your community we already have 2,000 supporters that are willing to come and patron your store if you would provide shelf space for this apple. And we've actually been doing outreach to retailers and packers, because the idea is to bring in all these different entities within the distribution system. One, to see where we can cut costs and maybe even cut out certain sectors, but primarily looking at how can we make this be one that puts at the forefront farm workers and growers, and yet at the same time is sustainable. So that's one thing that we're asking the folks. So we're doing actual committees that will be trained in that in the Seattle area to begin with, and also in Central Washington. Because another thing that we want, especially with the Central Washington group,
is that this is an opportunity for communities of faith that primarily have been supporters of farmers or supporters of farm workers to be able to really come together and both model and create spaces of dialogue for growers and moral support for them. Because one of the growers that's working with us was able to be in a room of 40 different people of faith from across the country that were there to listen. And you know, he broke down in the middle of his presentation because it was so impacting for him not to feel alone and to feel that there's actually consumers that care and are willing not only to, you know, take a day to go and be present to him, but are willing to take steps back when they go home. And it opened my eyes to the importance that growers are that are willing to partner with the enemy, because up until now, farm worker organizations have been seen as enemies to growers, and be able to take that step to partner with them and identify themselves more closely to farm workers are separating themselves from the rest of the industry and their communities, and it can lead to ostracization. It can lead to others that the packers or other people that supply tractors or things to them to start isolating them or even ruining them. And this has happened with farmers in California and Oregon that have taken stances. And so to be able to provide a moral support and a community support for these growers that are taking a big step towards Jubilee and to restoration, but all the same, for those that are perceiving them, see them as giving up their privilege. And giving up their white privilege as growers to ally themselves and to see that it's only working together with their brown brothers and sisters that real change or real sustainability is going to happen. And we also recognize that as farm workers and farm worker supporters, we you know, we are pro-organic and we are pro-sustainable practices, and our farm workers do have a lot of knowledge that we need to reap from them. But as supporters and allies, we have been accompaniers of the farm workers, and we haven't always been aware of or connected as we could be with our environmental and ecologically sustainable movements. And so we want to both learn from you and also bring this kind of race analysis and power analysis that we often feel is missing from the environmental movement. And so look to those new partnerships and new ways to both make this project something that's really possible and also hopefully enhance the movements that are already happening. So those are some things. I want to kind of open it up for questions and comments. And Jillian Ross is supposed to also be presenting with me today, but hopefully coming on the ferry tomorrow. And she's actually someone that I'm looking to partner with in Eastern Washington, both to support the work she does locally and help her link her work with this national network of folks that are also doing similar work. But mostly national farm producing tends to be more urban based because it's the consumer component of the movement. So, yeah.
What's, what has been the response from churches, or what gives you hope?
Well, I mean, a lot of things give me hope, I guess. One thing for me, why I'm so excited to be back in Washington is my hometown, my home state. But my own, like, personal experience is that why I went down to Oregon initially is because my dad is from Mexico, and he came up as a migrant worker to the Northwest when he was about 15 to Oregon, to the Willamette Valley. And so when I went back to work in that community where he first came, was really impacting, and not the most hopeful moment, but a really amazing, impacting moment was when my dad came down to visit my dad and my mother. He's like, you know, I think I remember where my camp, the labor camp that I lived in, is, and so we decided to drive to another county to where he was, and it's 40 years later, and the camp still is there, same shacks, same conditions. And it really impacted him and myself because you would want to think that 40 years later, some things have changed. And some things have, but a lot has remained the
for my own family's histories, because of the union, my dad now for the last 35 years has been working at a glass factory in Seattle, Ball Incorporated. They do the glass, the volume, the canning jars, and they also do lots of wines and beer bottles and all those things. But he's been there for 35 years, and it's because of the union, the union job, has made the world a difference for him. And my mom's side, they come from Northwest Ohio, from Mennonite farming community, where they didn't necessarily use a lot of farm workers, but people around them did, and you know, they had chickens and they had soy and they lived in this farming community, and for the most part, it's a beautiful community. It's this, you know, very deep roots of simplicity and faith and spirituality. And for me, it's been really an amazing opportunity, both in Oregon, when I was, we were working on a boycott, and churches were very much before, and part of the union, you know, part of our whole movement. You know, we're in a growing phase. I mean, because you're for us or you're against us. And if you are sitting and not waiting, not willing to make a decision, you're against us. And so the churches have become very one or the other. And what we're able to do is bring people together to do this. There's a first march that led to this video where we were able to bring both church people, environmental people, and folks that said that they were against the boycott, that they could come and march with us to reaffirm the right of farm workers to organize. And the Catholic Church had taken some really strong stances against us. But for at the very end, when we were organizing, finally the bishop was able to write a letter to all his churches saying, you know, inviting people to participate in schoolhouses that should be public spaces. At the last minute said that we couldn't use their space. And the churches opened up their spaces to us. And so we're able to really see the possibilities of transformations. And I think that's one thing that I feel like I've been able to bring to the movement. And I think it's one thing that the faith communities that accompany farm workers are able to bring is that people that the growers that are our enemies and have abused and oppressed us for so long, in so many cases in the Northwest, also are oppressed. And not only, you know, while they've been our enemies, we do believe and hope and work towards the opportunities in the days when we'll all be able to sit at the same table. And then they'll be our brothers and our sisters. And I think what we offer as communities of faith is that vision and that hope to keep that vision, that they also will be able to come. And always open, the person that spoke earlier today in this room, the importance of nonviolence is always leaving that door open so that people can stay safe. And I hadn't really thought about that so much, but I think that's really what the farmer is and where we are right now. Which is of the National Farm Worker Ministry, of other local ministries, these different consumer groups and retailers that are willing to sit with us, and growers that are willing to sit with us, this kind of backdoor, this other way of doing the agriculture that hopefully will not only lead to justice for those farm workers and farmers, but hopefully be something that contributes in a positive way to our rural communities. Because that's something that coming from the city and having both of my parents come from rural areas is something that I want to see, both as a city person and also someone that hopefully will move back to rural areas, of how we can help revitalize those in ways that are really life-changing.
Well, it seems to me that you're a good person to be in this position because of the passion and the history that you have. I mean, you have a lot of ownership on all of this. I mean,
yeah.
You're not some kind of passive bystander of all of that. I mean,
yeah,
this is
definitely
part of in your guts.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely is. It's something that's very heritage. It's, yeah, I studied theology at Seattle University, and I worked in campus ministry as like a community service organizer. And so my main interests or passions, you know, rooted into seventh grade when I had this amazing teacher that started talking about Central America and United Fruit Company and let's read the Bible from perspective of the poor. And I mean, I probably didn't get all, it's amazing how much as like the seventh grader, I think I just soaked all that in. And he showed us Romero for the first time, went to actually, and being someone that I just wasn't exposed to violence, and it was something that really impacted me. And so I always thought that's where I was gonna head, is to Central America. And then I went to study in Mexico and learned Spanish because I didn't grow up speaking Spanish. And came back and saw my mom's books, this old book that I always looked at and thought, it looks boring, it's so thick. It was really thick, and it's the autobiography of La Causa, which is the closest thing that he got to an autobiography of Cesar Chavez while he was alive, and it's written by Jack Levy. And it's just pretty much a conversation about the movement, and there's interviews from Dolores Huerta and primarily from Cesar Chavez. And for the first time, I mean, it was probably the first book I read where I really could identify with the person. He was American. He was raised Catholic. You know, his parents, worked as farm workers, and he himself did, which I hadn't. But for me, really brought together both my deep passion and my commitment to faith, because that's where I was raised, is in the church, and where I was exposed to any ideas of justice. I mean, I didn't realize that my little experience of church was so distinct from other people's experiences of church when they started going to Eastern Washington or going to other places. And also my passion for justice. And at that time, I didn't realize how passionate I was about food or agriculture, but you know, I got involved with the Fair Trade Coffee on campus and these boycotts. And it is something that I hope I will always come back to. And I'm grateful to be here, and I hope that this project moves forward, and I think it will.
How do the companies that have these good agreements with workers, how are they competing with the companies that keep up the crappy practices and right. stuff?
Well, I think there are a couple like ones that shine. There's Bear Creek Roses, which is a huge Jackins and Perkins, I think, is connected to it. But the two separate ones, they actually are doing amazing work, because what they've done is with the union, also there's an organization called FIELD, which don't ask me what it stands for, but is an organization that also helps bring, once the company signs a contract, they see some real improvements in productivity. Mm-hmm. And so that's one direct impact. They also, once, if they're open to hearing the workers, through their organizations, workers start bringing up ideas. You know, if you did this, it would provide, you know, it would be more successful. And that's one company that really has taken that to heart and has actually formed committees of management and workers that are like improvement committees. And they have really improved both profits, but also the lifestyle and the job workplace. Sacta San Michele in Columbia Crest actually is very profitable as well. The one downside for me, one of my struggles with working with unions, is that if you're really working and you're committed to company workers, where the most workers are the big corporations. And so you're supporting workers because you believe workers have the right, no matter where they work, to be treated with dignity and respect and health and safety. But like Sacta San Michele, actually what's happening is they're taking some of the profits and putting it into other areas of the work because it's U.S. Tobacco that owns that company. And so they're feeling hit elsewhere, but at the actual winery, they're doing well, again, because they have workers that have been there for 20 years that are now pensioning out, but have been very productive workforce and have really seen things from going completely adversary to total positive working relationship. Rarely bring anything to grievance, but because everything's able to be resolved through communications and the setup that the union's been able to help offer. questions. I mean, I know there's always, with immigration, one of the things that we're looking at, in order for agriculture to be sustainable, you have to have both improved working conditions, and we have to have both, then on legislative level, a way for people to have a road to citizenship or an opportunity to enjoy legal status here in this country. And so one of the things happening is, again, earlier Kate showed a video on the freedom rights and stuff in the South. And what we're looking at is actually having, there's going to be an immigrant freedom riot across the country, one starting in Seattle, will come through Yakima and Pasco on its way to, well, I think it'll be Colorado too. And then it'll go to DC and New York, but trying to bring after 9/11, because before 9/11 there was some progress being made. And after that it was totally expanded, the whole idea of a new type of legalization or amnesty. But for us, we don't really, even though in Jubilee terms you say forgiveness, but we don't think immigrants and third world countries need to ask for forgiveness. It's us, the people that have been oppressing them, or that have been stripping part of their dignity and their humanity away from them, that needs to restore ourselves by offering changes in the way that we've been treating them. And so the idea is to bring it back to awareness, this idea of legalization, what it would mean, not only for farm workers, but there's so many communities here in Washington that just live in the shadows right now. And so hoping that that will be one way that will start that process again. Okay. Any other questions or comments? One of the things I have too is just resources that we have. This is actually from last year, and I only have the Spanish brochures now. So, but it's Cosecha, and every year National Farm Worker Ministry puts up brochures that can be used as a worship service, incorporated in different ways, or be something that you have in your communities. It can be used as like a just like a meditation instead of prayers for a week. We have it to accompany kind of November, the idea, either between U.S. and Canadian Thanksgiving. You can order them for your church. And this year is taking a look at legalization, or slavery actually, that remains in our country, and using different worship services to do that, both in English and Spanish. So if you're interested in that, if you want to get on my sign-up sheets, you'll receive alerts from me, and be connected both to what's happening in Washington State and other things as it pertains, but primarily to help once we have these apples and have actions and things that for y'all to do, you'll have access to that. I think that basically it. So if there's any other comments or questions, we can just close with the farmer clap, which is just everyone together, bringing your claps slowly together, and then we just keep on moving that momentum, because when we clap wild, we make lots of noise, and that's great, but sometimes we need to come and organize ourselves so we can feel that power that we have, both individually but mostly collectively, to bring change. And it's with that collective power of consumers and workers coming together that we're able to bring justice to our land. So, si se puede, it can be done.